The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Wednesdays here on the Audio Stash, we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine about the science of cannabis. Dr. Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. He's also editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to both books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wonderful to have you back today, Mitch. Today we're going to explore the issue of racism. Because marijuana prohibition enforcement is essentially doled out along racial lines, and the issue is really inseparable from the topic of marijuana reform. So let's discuss the psychology of racism in America. First, how do people respond psychologically when they encounter people of a different ethnicity?
It's a curious set of findings, Chris. The data from MRI studies, pictures of people's brains while they're looking at folks of other ethnic groups, suggests that at least in a subset of folks, the areas of the brain associated with fear get activated almost automatically, so just at the sight of people of other ethnic groups, and that, you know, this is something we'd all have to battle quite consciously in order to keep racist attitudes from appearing. Other measures of implicit attitudes about folks in other ethnic groups suggest that even though we, you know, take our conscious steps to avoid these kinds of racist attitudes, some of them are activated automatically, even at the names of certain races or names of people that are even associated with stereotypes of a particular race.
Mitch, when it comes to active racism and bigotry, what is at play here outside of those environmental factors, or is that just inherently part of it?
In fact, you can imagine how difficult that is to sort through. Once you see somebody, how can you not, you know, monitor and immediately access the idea that they're in a race that's different from you? And part of the, you know, challenge to us all is to go ahead and make sure that any decision we make about another person is based on, you know, data other than their ethnic group or even their socioeconomic status.
And what about those authority figures creating an institutional form of racism, as we see with marijuana enforcement? Does that happen because people do not recognize race factors in themselves, that they perceive themselves as not being racist, but unconsciously they act in a racist manner?
The data suggests that really is the case, even to the point where when folks aren't even evaluating an individual person, but they're setting up criteria for what they're looking for, they unconsciously select things that would bias, set up biases against members of certain race because they're associated with values that might be different from the values of that company or group.
And how do we combat that? When we talk about unconscious perceptions, how do we change those?
I think the key a lot of these is to have real specific definable guidelines about anything you want to have happen on a particular job or with particular, you know, legal enforcement or things along those lines. So a specific example we're finding in admissions, for example, that a number of the tests that students take to get admitted to college have biases against folks who've grown up in, you know, socioeconomic conditions that aren't optimal. And so keeping that in mind when we interpret test scores seems to be moderately helpful. Of course, then folks say, well, this is somehow unfair to folks who've grown up in the other context, or, you know, white students are getting biased against. But in fact, that doesn't seem to be the case when you start running the statistics on how some of these tests are biased against folks. I'm also finding in job evaluation literature in industrial and organizational psychology, if you have really specific defined goals, like you should raise this much money or you should, you know, sell this many widgets, those tend to be easier to justify and explain and are less likely to run into racist things than more subjective things about you're supposed to have a certain attitude or you're supposed to present a certain way, and then that's where racist things can really creep into the evaluations of job performance.
And Mitch, as a college professor, how do you see academia dealing with the issue of racism in America? Are we doing it effectively, or is there some hesitance to bring this up in the classroom or lecture setting?
It's tough. It's not an easy topic to discuss, particularly in the United States right now. I'm pleased with how, you know, higher education has offered more classes in an attempt to address some of these issues. Some of my, you know, students who are you know, stereotypically ethnic minorities say they're reluctant to sign up for these classes because they're concerned that when people then evaluate their transcripts, they're going to be perceived as some kind of militant member of their ethnic group. So it's still a tough battle. I feel like at least in psychology and sociology and other social sciences, we're devoting more lectures to these issues, even in courses that aren't designed around person perception or just racism in general, and I'm happy to see that happen. But we've got a long way to go, and I think the key may be just, you know, spending more and more time, money, effort, et cetera, on these issues. When it does come to admissions, I've been pleased to see, even at the graduate level, folks are much more willing to say, hey, we know this test is biased against this person because of the ethnic group or socioeconomic status they grew up in, so let's, you know, cut them some slack. If they're a few points lower, I don't think we should overinterpret that, and let's take a closer look at things like teaching evaluations or, you know, other sorts of ways of assessing their performance before we just toss them in the not admit pile.
And Mitch, what about this broader topic of race relations? This is a hot button topic in places like New York City, where we see outrage at police shootings. So is the issue of race relations something that we can tackle as individuals or something that has to be tackled as a society?
I think we got to have a multi-pronged approach. You know, we all saw John Getman's wonderful report suggesting that, hey, there are real disparities in arrest rates for ethnic minorities and Caucasians when you look at the cannabis-related crimes. And what is the source of this? Well, when you talk to folks in law enforcement, they say, oh, it has to do with who uses drugs outside, who tends to deal drugs in an open setting versus in their homes, et cetera. But it's hard to look at these data and not say, how come somebody with a darker face is suddenly more likely to get arrested? And I don't think it's that anybody's necessarily out there to try to bust a certain ethnic group, but we do have these unconscious biases that fire up automatically when we see folks, and so keeping that in mind is the way to go. I think, you know, trying to legislate, you know, good attitudes about race has been a real stumbling block here. And I think it's much more important to say, let's have really specific objective criteria for how we're going to, you know, enforce laws, make decisions about hiring, et cetera. And then one-on-one, let's spend more time together, because we are learning that familiarity, particularly in relaxed, social, fun settings with people who are, you know, stereotypically different physically, tend to decrease some of these racist attitudes. So kids who play with other kids who are from different ethnic groups are more likely to appreciate and love folks of other ethnic groups. And that is, in many ways, the way we can plant the seeds to prevent this in the future.
And for people of color in America, is racism an everyday factor? Is it something that affects the lives of anyone non-white in the country every day?
In fact, it's so dramatic that it's hard for me to even pretend I can understand as a white guy. The data on hypertension, on cardiovascular disease, on stress-related illness, on post-traumatic stress, all of these health-related outcomes are clearly tougher for folks of ethnic minorities and folks of lower socioeconomic status. And some of them may be heritable. It looks like maybe African Americans metabolize salt differently, or you know, something along those lines that might account for very small proportions of this. But more often than not, it's just a matter of waking up every day knowing that you could be, you know, literally, you know, biased against in every single interaction you have because of something that is completely outside your control, completely have nothing to do with your abilities, your skills, your attitudes, your beliefs, etc., and yet you're still going to suffer as a result. What an unfair life, and what a horrible thing to have to wake up to day after day after day. And it's impossible for us to imagine because we just don't have it.
Now, Mitch, we've been talking about the disparity of marijuana enforcement in New York City and really everywhere in America, but isn't it true that white people use marijuana and other substances at much higher rates than people of color?
Oh, in fact, I mean, there are subsets of Latinas who don't use any drugs at all and don't even drink alcohol, and yet somehow the arrest data suggests that there are biases against them, too. And I don't mean to suggest that law enforcement is out there just trying to throw every minority into jail. It's just that there are certain subsets of folks who seem to have these things activated, and then there are certain habits that are associated with different neighborhoods, cultures, subgroups that seem to increase these rates of arrest. I think it's worth it to spread the word, even in minority communities, that it's not a good idea to use drugs outside your home. It's definitely not a good idea to purchase drugs out on the street, and that that increases your risk for arrest. But also we need to, you know, discuss the big issue, and that's why don't we repeal these laws that are creating so many problems in order to make it so that people can go about their day, have functional lives, do a good job, and raise their children, do the things they need to do in order to, you know, have a good life.
So, Mitch, now for the big question. Is marijuana prohibition itself a racist policy?
When you look back at the history of marijuana prohibition in particular, it was anti-Mexican sentiment, basically, that helped pass those laws. Early laws in, you know, small towns in Texas right along the border suggested that, you know, marijuana was going to be the source of all these terrible ills. As Woody Harrelson has suggested in the movie Grass, it's not that it controlled marijuana so much as it controlled Mexicans. And when you look at Harry Anslinger's discussions with Congress and passing the Marijuana Tax Act back in the 1930s, it was very much this concern that there was going to be miscegenation of the races, that somehow African-American and Latino folks were going to end up seducing white women if this drug was allowed to be around. And, I mean, those seem so laughable to us today, and yet those were the very rationales that were presented in order to pass the laws that prohibited marijuana in the first place.
Oh, Mitch, this has been another fascinating conversation today. I really do appreciate you joining us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash.
Super. Always happy to help.
And thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. He's also editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com, and Mitch joins us each Wednesday for our Cannabis Science segment.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Continuing our conversation on race and marijuana prohibition today. Next, we'll speak with one of the nation's most respected journalists and political commentators, Clarence Page. Clarence is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a frequent guest on shows such as the McLaughlin Group, offering in-depth analysis of our political landscape. Clarence has been a longtime supporter of marijuana reform and has spoken frequently on the topic. Clarence, welcome back to the program today.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Thanks again for taking time to speak with us here on the Audio Stash today, Clarence. Just last week, we reported on a study of arrest data in New York City that showed people of color in the city get arrested and receive harsher penalties for marijuana violations. Now, has that racial disparity always existed?
Well, sadly enough, it's been going on for a long, long time, and it's certainly been confirmed by various research groups, the Sentencing Project, the Justice Policy Institute, for studies of both juveniles and adults you can see that there's a big racial disparity in enforcement. And it seems to be accounted for, but well, at every step of the line, that for as far as arrests go, blacks and Hispanics are more likely to be arrested, more likely to be stopped and frisked, less likely to have adequate legal counsel when they are in custody, and more likely to receive harsher sentences. So this follows that pattern, and even though marijuana is the least serious of illegal recreational drugs, it follows the same pattern as the more serious drugs.
And Clarence, can we look at all of this data and say that marijuana prohibition enforcement is really a form of institutionalized racism in our country?
Yeah, that's it fits that definition, certainly, of systemic racism in terms of how the system is weighted against certain people of color, and that leads to cyclical forms of discrimination. Police profiling, for example, more likely to stop a young black male, say, than a young white male, even though the two may be dressed in similar fashion. And this leads to more involvement in the criminal justice system, to the point where studies, well, a sentencing project some years ago arched eyebrows by showing that 25% or more black males between ages of 18 and their late 20s were involved in some way in the criminal justice system, either jail, arrest, or awaiting trial, or on parole.
So is this one issue, marijuana prohibition, even drug policy in general, are these issues a wrench in the works for American race relations right now?
I think it's one wrench, certainly. The thing that really strikes me about marijuana is that here is a drug that most Americans we can see would like to legalize it, at least for medicinal purposes. And even the government, I have found, has covered up the fact that people are still being arrested and held and sentenced for marijuana offenses. I had two different drug czars tell me to my face that, oh, nobody gets arrested for marijuana anymore. I mean, like this casual comment as if I was just going to accept that and questioning further, they had to admit, oh, well, yeah, there are some. You know, I mean, this is the kind of thing that really strikes me about the marijuana arrests, because our society is just so two-faced about it, and our Congress is so two-faced about it, with overwhelming evidence of public support for at least medicinal marijuana. You can't get more than a minority of voters in the House to vote for it, to go on record voting for it, although that minority has slowly been growing every year.
And looking broader here, we know that the government's own data shows 94 million Americans aged 12 and up have tried marijuana once in their lifetime, almost 40% of the country as a whole. So is marijuana really an inherent part of American culture?
Well, which culture? American culture is many cultures. I laughed up my sleeve in the early 90s when I heard Pat Buchanan and others talking about culture war, but I don't laugh anymore because, you know, just because you haven't declared war doesn't mean somebody else hasn't declared war on you. And we do have certainly a culture clash, culture conflict on many different lines, and marijuana is one of them. When it comes to legality, there's a, you know, as I said, there's a minority of people who support keeping it illegal, not just illegal, but a class one drug, you know, under federal law. I mean, it's ranked like up there with heroin, you know, or maybe it's above heroin. I don't have the chart right in front of me right now, but it's totally unrealistic the way it's ranked under law. But that group that wants to keep it there is a small but vocal minority, vocal enough that they've got Washington scared into just being paralyzed. And that's, and you know, who suffers for that is the people who have the least power. That means low income, racial and ethnic minorities who don't have clout and who are already being stereotyped anyway. So that's what's really sad about this. So that's, and I'm afraid that whole matrix, if you will, is certainly embedded in American culture. And over time, it's changing as public opinions are changing. But I think one big reason why it doesn't change faster is because there's just so much public ignorance out there.
Where was Chicago Tribune columnist and political commentator Clarence Page? Clarence, so much of our current events are dominated by questions of government authority right now and individual civil liberties. The FBI illegally collecting data on innocent Americans and the Patriot Act being used politically with the Attorney General. So do you think that modern marijuana prohibition has, you know, softened up Americans to these types of encroachments by government?
I'm sure that us baby boomers, those of us who came of age back in the 60s and 70s, our attitudes being a lot more libertarian than our parents on issues like marijuana, that has had an impact. As I say, unfortunately, not enough of an impact, but enough that, you know, when I go over on Capitol Hill, I could see this bipartisan coalition of folks who want to liberalize marijuana laws, like Dana Rohrabacher, conservative Republican, on one extreme, and then you've got a lot of liberal Democrats on the other extreme, but they work together on this issue in seeing that our current laws are unrealistic. And when you've got unrealistic laws on the books, that just decreases the public's respect for the law.
Clarence, you were in the Army and then worked as a police beat reporter, and now look at all aspects of politics in America. How have you personally seen marijuana, you know, interacting in our culture?
Well, certainly it is something that's a part of the coming of age experience of a lot of young people. And it's interesting for me now as a parent who's got a 17-year-old son how much more conservative I am now about this than I was as a kid. But I'm also scared to death of my son. Say if he were to go out there and experiment with marijuana or be with some friends who've got it in their pockets, I know that's happened. You know, him just being there in the presence, what if they get busted by cops on the street who stop them? My son's going to be right in there with the rest of them, and I get that phone call at night. And I've had friends of mine who have or have had teenage sons who said, well, just expect it, you know, any night now it can happen, because it's so much a part of American life. So even as a parent who does not want my son to engage in recreational drugs, at least until he is of age to make those kind of decisions for himself, I'm still scared of these laws because he can get roped in just like anybody else.
And what are those differences in experience between what happened when you were growing up and the experience your son is having today?
One difference is my son is more likely to be hanging out with a mixed race group than my generation was, and very mixed. I mean, my son's friends are black, white, Hispanic, and Asian, and mixtures of each of those, not to mention Native American. You know, that's great. That's a wonderful thing. But we also can't be too sanguine about the idea that our kids won't grow up with misguided racial notions. They just have different kind of standards than we do, or use a different language because they are kids. You know, my son and I talk about this quite a bit because I'm always fascinated by their world, and especially when I need help with the internet and other things that they're much more adept with. And I'm happy my kid at least, I think, you know, has a core of good values. He can be as nutty as any other teenager and he'll go off and do some crazy things, but I think he's, you know, when I don't know where he is past curfew, I hold on to the good faith that his core values are going to bring him home safe and sound, and so far that has worked, that's the best a parent can do. But simply passing a law that says, kid found out after curfew in the presence of somebody else who's got marijuana or whatever, you know, throw them in jail. Like, that's just going to solve the problem of teenagers who make youthful mistakes. That is just ludicrous, and it's downright tragic.
Now, Clarence, how about the broader picture of racism today? some would argue, probably white people in homogenous communities in somewhat upper-class environments, they might argue that racism is a thing of the past, dealt with civil rights. But is racism still really at work out there today?
Sure. I mean, there is no epiphanous moment where we have no racism anymore. You know, that doesn't happen. You know, is there anti-Semitism today? Yes. Does it prevent Jewish kids from being what they want to be in American society? I think most people would say no, it doesn't. And I think the same thing is true of racism. You know, when I was a kid, there were still white and colored signs on restrooms and water fountains when I went to visit my relatives in the South. And there were restaurants in the North where my family could not go and sit down for dinner. We could go in and get a carry out. A hot dog or hamburger in a brown paper bag, but we couldn't sit down. I'm talking about in Ohio and Illinois and Indiana, you know, upper Midwest where I grew up. Yeah, we've come a long way since those days. So you got to look at it on a scale of 0 to 10, you know. If it was 9 back then compared to South Africa apartheid, as a perfect 10, you could say that today it's down to about a 2 or a 3. But the people who are still affected by that, and our day-to-day interactions that are still affected by that are still painful, and they are serious. We cannot just dismiss it all and say that, well, racism doesn't exist anymore. Just look at the numbers of complaints that still get filed by the federal filed at the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or at the Equal Rights Commissions in the 50 states or the local housing and job discrimination centers. And just look at the misunderstandings that erupt all the time, even to Michael Richards, the comedian, and using the N-word and all. There's still all kinds of misunderstanding in our society around that. And so we've still got to be aware of the legacy of racism in our society and understand that it's a serious matter. You know, there's the there are these polarized politics that we have these days, where conservatives will say, all their kid has to do is just study hard and work hard, and they can move on up. You know, what if you've got bad schools? What if you've got a really disorderly home, and your options are totally limited in your neighborhood, if you want to call it a neighborhood? It's a pocket of poverty where you've got all kinds of temptations around you, and among them are the option of being a drug dealer or being a recreational marijuana user out on the street where cops are going to see you and haul you in or just haul you in on suspicion, walking while black, and they haul you in on suspicion, and you happen to have a reefer in your pocket or your friend does. You know, those kind of things do have an impact, and that's what drags down our cities. It's what drags down our school systems. The way we got to be aware of it and not pretend that we don't have a problem.
And last week you joined us to discuss the 1972 Schaefer Commission report that was, of course, dismissed by President Nixon in Congress at the time. But in 1972, there were many of the same issues we're dealing with today. War, poverty, health care. That even though the issue of marijuana prohibition affects tens of millions of Americans, that elected officials and politicians think that the issue is trumped by those other concerns.
It does get trumped. You know, why things stay the way they are, I can only say it has to be fear of the unknown, that there's so many Americans who are still reluctant to deal with the notion of it just being flat-out legal. They can't quite get their mental arms around that. As I mentioned, the idea of medicinal marijuana is rapidly gaining acceptance, and a referendum for it passed in one state after another, and more legislators are favoring it. And I think the difference there is people think of it in terms of herbal medicine. And herbal medicine or alternative medicine is so much a part of our lives already. That's much easier and a lot less frightening for people, and not only that, but downright helpful, because the idea of giving relief to the ill is just such a basic fundamental human impulse, and also the notion that, hey, maybe I might need this someday, you know, maybe I'll have chemotherapy or something else, glaucoma or whatever, where I will be turning to this alternative. So I think that's the break point there. That, but nevertheless, there's still so much fear of marijuana that we can't get these legislators moved. You know, you can't get enough of the move to even legalize medicinal marijuana on the federal level.
Clarence, this has been a wonderful conversation today. I just so appreciate you joining us here on the Audio Stash to share your own experience and talk about this issue.
Thank you for inviting me, and best of luck to you.
Clarence Page is a political commentator and columnist at the Chicago Tribune. We have links to his articles on our website today at normalaudiostash.com.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's NORMALAUDIOSTASH.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.